Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Anderson Foundation, Devro TPAC Danville, Jarman Senior Apartments Tuscola, and Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Again, in this hour, we bring you a show from the Focus 580 archives. This program first broadcast on the 10th of November. As you listen, do keep in mind in this hour of Focus, we will not be taking calls. Since the late 1960s, public art in America has increasingly been the subject of heated political debate. And I'm sure that people will remember some of these debates about the work of artists like Andre Serrano, Robert Mapplethorpe, Judy Chicago, just to name three. Our guest this morning, historian Michael Kamen, says that although we might think this kind of conflict is new, it's not. In fact, he argues, from the early years of the American Republic, back then, all the way to the present, art and architecture have consistently aroused major disputes involving artists and politicians and citizens. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will sample some of this controversy as we talk with Michael Kamen about his book Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. It is out now, new in the bookstores, published by Knopf. And if you're interested in the book, you can go out and take a look at it. Michael Kamen is Newton C. Farr, Professor of American History and Culture at Cornell University. He's also past president of the Organization of American Historians, has authored a number of books, and won a number of awards for his work, including a Pulitzer Prize, also the Francis Parkman Prize, and the Henry Adams. Professor Kamen, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Just to start, maybe, we might talk a little bit about the two pictures that are on the cover of the book. One, and actually I think both of them, probably people would look at them and think, well, I'm not quite sure that I think those are terribly shocking or controversial, but in their time, there certainly were. One of them is a photograph of a sculpture by Brancusi, which is titled Bird in Flight. Let's save that for a minute, because I want to go to the other one, which certainly I would think a lot of people would say, well, what's controversial about that? And that is, it's a photograph of the Washington Monument. The beginning section of the book does talk about monuments and controversies over monuments, and people may indeed think, when you mention that, they might think about the controversy originally about the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. But I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, Washington Monument, what's controversial about that? When it was first proposed, there was a lot of controversy about it.
There was indeed. There were various reasons for the controversy. First, the people who wanted to honor the 100th anniversary of Washington's birth, 1732 to 1832, had proposed that he be dug up from Mount Vernon and reburied in the crypt of the United States Capitol. But Washington's descendants fought that off because it would have violated Washington's will. He had chosen to be buried at Mount Vernon. They won their court case. And so the next step was to figure out some other way to honor him in Washington, D.C., and there were conflicting views. One major proposal that actually was completed, but not without controversy, involved a larger-than-life-size statue of Washington seated, and that was unveiled in 1842 and caused a hue and a cry. But meanwhile, there was a sense that something truly colossal, truly monumental, should be erected in the area that we now think of as the Mall, but at that time only had the U.S. Capitol at one end and the White House sort of to the side, but about a mile and a half away. The Robert Mills was the federal architect who was commissioned to design a monument, and Mills had very, very grandiose ideas. He wanted the whatever got erected to be the tallest structure in the world, and he originally envisioned it being 650 feet high rather than what ended up being 555 feet high. but he also intended it to be surrounded by a Doric colonnade from ancient Greece, with also all sorts of other structures nearby, possibly four pyramids surrounding the work. And the sheer grandiosity of the project alarmed a lot of people. But the single biggest problem was involved the question of who was going to pay for it, because there was no provision for Congress to pay for it. So private funding, or funding from the private sector, had to be sought. That proved to be very, very difficult. And so in 1855, work which began in 1848 stopped. And it was called, people referred to it as the brick chimney, because it was only about, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 to 25% of the intended height. And it became increasingly embarrassing that the brick chimney just stood there. And finally, in 1876, which was the 100th anniversary of American independence, Congress was really shamed into appropriating some money to complete it, and the Army Corps of Engineers did so, and it was finally finished in 1885, but delayed again because of congressional parsimoniousness.
Hmm. Well, when it was finally completed and people saw what it was, what it looked like, what was the reaction? Did people like it? Were there a lot of people who said, I think that it's an eyesore?
No, no one said it was an eyesore, because it was, except in the sense that it was so huge, in a setting where there was virtually nothing else of any height at all. Mostly people were relieved that at last the project had been completed, and they wondered, well, what else is going to go on this mall? Because the mall at that time consisted of basically six gardens, each one under the oversight of a different congressional committee, and the gardens were not well kept. So the vision people have today of the mall in Washington is of a pristine space that's very well cared for, that's lined with mostly neoclassical structures, and that there's an ensemble effect. But in 1885, when the Washington Monument was finished, there was really almost the only other structure on the mall was the building we call the Smithsonian Castle, which is a sort of sandstone, semi-Gothic structure, and that sits rather low. It's much more horizontal than vertical, and compared to the Washington Monument, the contrast is very striking. The two didn't seem to belong together, and yet they were not very far apart. So the anomaly of this disjunction between an obelisk on the one hand and a Gothic castle on the other seemed rather bizarre. There's one other aspect of the controversy involving the Washington Monument. The question arose once the commission was given to Mills. Well, what should the structure look like? And there was a big debate over whether it should be a column or an obelisk. And both, of course, were referencing antiquity. But there had already been a column erected in Washington's honor in Baltimore in 1829. And so the feeling was, well, he's already got a column there, and Washington is on top of that column, and it's still standing in Baltimore. They turned somewhat reluctantly to an obelisk. There was favoritism for columns because that referenced Greece and antiquity. But the virtue of an obelisk was that because it has four flat sides, you can carve inscriptions on it. But needless to say, no inscriptions were ever carved on it. And by 1885, I'm not sure anyone really still envisioned there being inscriptions. But that this debate over a colossal column versus a colossal obelisk went on during the 1840s until the project finally got started. And it lingered, actually, virtually until the time the monument was finished in 1885. Hmm.
So that suggests that going at least back that far, people were arguing about some of the same things that we argue about, one being the use of public money to build some or to fund some kind of artwork and whether it should be spent or not. And then the other thing would just be what it is that we think is attractive and what is it that we want to look at. And perhaps also there's another set of questions in here about the fact that almost anything has some. It makes some political statement. There's some kind of political content, and that also gives people something to argue about.
Right. What I would add to your question about what would make it attractive was the question, what would make it American? That question would ultimately cause both the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial to become very controversial, because with each of these monuments and memorials, the people calling the shots were basically looking back to antiquity. But their critics kept saying, why can't we have something that's distinctively American? And actually that rhetorical question got raised in all sorts of other controversies that came up subsequently and that I treat in other chapters. Mm-hmm. So there were fans of doing something that referenced either ancient Greece or ancient Rome, because they were not monarchies, at least not the Roman Republic, and others saying that America is a modern state, it's a republic, and therefore it should have something that speaks of our contemporary society.
Yeah. Maybe just one more thing that I might ask you to talk a little bit about that also you treat in the section on monuments, memorials, and Americanism is the Vietnam Memorial. And as I mentioned, the fact that initially the reactions to the design and perhaps also to the memorial itself there was a lot of people who did not like it. Now, attitudes have changed greatly, and among other things, I guess that gives an opportunity to make the overall point that while some things might initially seem to be shocking, controversial, get people upset, most, not everything, but many things, eventually people get used to them, and in some cases they even decide that they like them.
That's absolutely right. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial exemplifies that better than virtually any other instance I can think of, because in 1981-82, when the design in the anonymous competition was revealed to be by a young woman of Chinese American descent who was still an undergraduate student at Yale in the architecture program there, people were quite horrified. They referred to it as that black gash in the earth. Many Vietnam veterans felt deeply offended, and people wanted something representational rather than postmodern and very abstract. Ross Perot had provided the money for the competition, and Perot was very upset, and the Secretary of the Interior, appointed by Ronald Reagan, James Watt, was very upset, and anything going up on the mall requires the approval of the Department of the Interior. So there was a huge ruckus, and the compromise that finally got worked out was negotiated by the Fine Arts Commission, which was chaired by the director of the National Gallery of Art, J. Carter Brown, and the winning design by Maya Lin could only proceed if there were also to be a representational and very traditional statue that, as it turned out, showed three servicemen, one white, one African-American, one Hispanic. And that statue stands fairly near the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. But throughout the 1980s, it continued to have its detractors. By the early 1990s, they had quieted down. And now, and perhaps for the last, I would say for the last 10 or perhaps even 15 years, it's turned out to be the most visited memorial in the United States and in many ways the most admired. And memorials that have been constructed or erected since then all suffer by comparison with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which now has won almost universal applause.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Michael Kamen. He's professor of American history and culture at Cornell. and is author of a new book. It's titled Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. It is published by Knopf, and overall makes the point that the kind of controversy that we have seen, particularly since the 1960s, and people, I'm sure, will remember some of these controversies of the 90s, these things are not new. Perhaps some of those recent ones have been very intense, but some of those in the past have also been rather intense. And he makes the overall point that art controversies are connected with social change. They can reflect social change. In some cases, they can even provoke social change. And again, if you're interested in reading the story, you can look for the book Visual Shock. And here on the program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to shift focus here and talk a little bit, have you talk a little bit about the Brancusi sculpture that's here also on the cover. As I mentioned, the fact that there were these two photographs on the cover, they're side by side. One on one side is the Washington Monument, and on the other side is a photograph of the Brancusi bronze sculpture, Bird in Flight, or Bird in Space, pardon me. And it was my thought that probably today people would look at that sculpture and say, well, that's not terribly shocking or controversial, but when it was first shown, a lot of people had that reaction. And I'm thinking about your comment that when people propose designs for the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson, that people were saying, well, maybe we should have something more American. Well, I guess that makes me think about the reaction to a lot of what was at the time contemporary art, and that perhaps one of the grounds people find to reject it or to oppose it was saying that somehow something about it was un-American, and that and this and certainly others might have gotten that kind of tag. So if you could talk a little bit about this early reaction to this particular work and other things.
Sure. Brancusi was born in Romania but moved to Paris, where he was in the early 20th century, where he was part of the artistic avant-garde that was increasingly attracted to abstraction, to works that are suggestive of their subject matter but not directly representational. And Brancusi actually had works that were displayed in the notorious Armory Show of 1913. In any case, Bird in Space is his best-known work, and he did it in various media. He did it he made versions of it in marble, in wood, and as you point out, the 1926 version in brass. And what happened was that Edward Steichen, one of the two leading figures in American photography, he, along with Alfred Stieglitz, basically made photography a fine art early in the 20th century. Steichen went to Paris in 1926. He had seen a different version previously of Bird in Space, and so he purchased a copy from Brancusi, or a version from Brancusi, and brought it back to the U.S. A couple of curators at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who were quite conservative and traditional in their orientation, knew that it was Steichen's intent to bring this back in, and so they tipped off the customs inspectors at the Port of New York, so that when Steichen arrived with Bird in Space, they opened it, and they refused to admit it duty-free as art. Instead, they placed a duty on it, designating it as plumbing supplies. Well, Steichen, along with Brancusi, brought a lawsuit, and it took more than 2 years for the case to be resolved. But initially, the ruling held that if it didn't look like a bird and it didn't seem to be in space, then it wasn't a work of art. Finally, to make a long story short, in 1928, a tribunal of three judges changed that verdict, and according to two criteria. First, the definition of a work of art included the stipulation that it had to be made by someone recognized professionally as an artist. And Brancusi qualified because works of his had been displayed in 1913 at the Armory Show, and there was no question but that he was a professional artist. And then in a very thoughtful and progressive opinion, the chief judge of this tribunal acknowledged that over the centuries, in fact over the millennia, standards for judging art had changed, and that perhaps in 1926 the United States or the world, the art world, was on the cusp of yet another change. So that, and therefore, even though this sort of spiraling, graceful work that one doctor, by the way, took a look at it later and said it looked to him like a suppository. And it does indeed have exactly that shape. But the judge ruled that perhaps the art world was on the cusp of another significant change, and since Brancusi clearly was a professional artist, it should be admitted as a work of art. And there are now there are two examples by Brancusi on display in at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. The one that Steichen bought is on display at the Museum of Modern Art, and there are a couple of other examples scattered elsewhere in the country.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so let us do that. And they're in Belgium, community not very far away from here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. I caught part of your show, and I'm not sure if comments I'm going to make are completely appropriate, but let's see. As a child, it was my job to go along to all these monuments in D.C. I went to lots of them all the time. And in those days, you mentioned that the Washington Monument was supposed to have a tableau on the outside and stuff to talk about, and it was never made. But as I remember, we preferred to walk up. Now, you can't do that today except if special tours. But on the inside of the monument, all the way up, there's just amazing number of carvings into the stones from each state and each kind of organization that wanted to put something into it, and statements about all kinds of things where just, you know, you just go up and down and you read them. And I was always impressed with that, even though they didn't put it on the outside, they put it on the inside.
You're quite right.
And it was real, real interesting. Also, I thought your statement about the Vietnam Memorial, it's powerfully moving. I mean, it is amazing how ugly it seemed before it was actually built and how powerful it was after it got done being built. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
When you first heard about it, you said, oh, that doesn't sound very pretty. But when you stand there, it's one of the most moving things you'll ever see because of the reflection of yourself back in it, which is probably the most powerful aspect as far as I can see.
No, and you're exactly right.
And the other aspect about the mall, and I thought was interesting, is when they put the I.M. Pei building next to the National Gallery of Art, which is so totally different. I.M. Pei being extremely modernistic in its way, and next to the Gallery of Art, which is essentially they're connected, I think, underground. I'm not sure about
that's
that.
That's true. That's correct.
And one is totally classical, and one is totally modern. And if you go into the I.M. Pei building, what do you call those floating things across mobiles across the top?
Big Calder mobile.
Yes, they're fabulous mobiles. You look at them. How can they have ever gotten them up there and kept them from falling down? But I could go on and on about each one of the buildings. Like I said, I've spent many hours in all of them, and into many of the memorials, of which I think probably the most overlooked one is the Jefferson Memorial. It sits there all by itself, kind of off to the side, but yet it's so beautiful, and it's so nice and round, and the man is looking out into the future, I think, I would say. I don't know exactly what he's looking towards. But anyway, just a comment or two, it's mainly about the Washington Monument is what I wanted to make the comment about.
Well, your comments are very well informed. As for the Washington Monument, you're quite right that there are many different sorts of inscriptions on the inside. But interestingly, the Vatican actually sent a stone to be set on the inside with carvings on it. And during the 1850s, there was a very strong nativistic strain in America, and there was a good deal of anti-Catholicism. So when the Know Nothing Party, which was the party of the nativists, learned that a stone had been sent by the Vatican and placed in the Washington, inside the Washington Monument, they snuck in the middle of the night, removed this large stone, and took it to the Potomac River and threw it in. So there's that little episode that most people are not familiar with. Your point about the IMPA addition to the basically to the east of the National Gallery of Art is interesting because it does contrast very strikingly with most of the traditional neoclassical structures on the Mall. But the IMPA building went up in the early 70s at the same time that the Hirshhorn Museum was added to the Mall, and that caused a huge controversy because when in 1970, when critics saw the design, they said it's going to be the world's largest bagel or the world's largest donut because it is round and it does have a hole in the middle. And many people were very upset, thought it didn't belong on the Mall. But it finally opened in 1974. So between the Hirshhorn Museum, which was controversial for still other reasons, and the IMPA addition, that sort of broke the sequence of traditionally classical structures on the Mall.
Well, I want to thank the caller, and others who are listening are certainly welcome to call if you have questions and comments. And I should introduce again our guest, Michael Kamen. He's professor of American History and Culture at Cornell University. He's also past president of the Organization of American Historians, has won a number of awards for his work, including a Pulitzer Prize. His new book is Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. It's published by Knopf, and as you will understand if you've been listening for a while, it looks at these kind of controversies, things that perhaps sometimes we might think of as being a recent phenomenon in American history, and he points out in his book that, in fact, it is not. These sorts of controversies go back to the beginnings of America, right back at least to that point when we were building monuments in the early years of the American Republic. Questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess
David,
quick
footnote
yes.
to the last caller's remark about the Jefferson Memorial being neglected. I don't think it doesn't have quite the same iconic stature as the Lincoln Memorial, for example, because great gatherings can occur in front of the Lincoln Memorial, such as the March on Washington in 1963, when Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous I Have a Dream speech. But we shouldn't forget that late March, early April, every year, when the cherry blossoms, cherry trees come into blossom for about 2.5 to 3 weeks, and there's a big cherry blossom festival. Those trees basically surround the tidal basin where the Jefferson Memorial is located, and so there are enormous numbers of visitors who enjoy the whole panorama of the cherry blossoms and the Jefferson Memorial, and they certainly go into the memorial and read extracts from Jefferson's famous writings, including the Declaration of Independence.
When people think about some of the recent controversies, they, I'm sure, will associate that with what we have now come to call the culture wars here in the United States, and that the combatants here often are the artists on one side, and on the other side, people like politicians, political activists, people who are involved with various kinds of interest groups that have particular agendas. What I am interested in having you talk a little bit about is how, though in many cases, often the kinds of attacks on various works of art don't come from the outside, in a sense, they come from the inside. That is, other artists, people who run art museums, art schools sometimes, art students sometimes, and that a lot of the controversy and the attack on particular works of art have indeed come from other artists.
That's absolutely correct. And again, it's not a new phenomenon at all. There's a tendency to refer, I'll put the words in scare quotes, the art world, as though the art world was monolithic and entirely shared one opinion, and that has never been true. In 1913, when the Armory Show came to the United States, the art world was very divided. Some critics were quite horrified. Other critics tried to come to terms with or understand post-impressionism, which is what the Armory Show was all about. And when the Armory Show got to Chicago, students at the art school of the Art Institute of Chicago were horrified, in particular, by a nude painted by Henri Matisse. And they burned Matisse in effigy, they burned the painting in effigy, they worked up all sorts of skits to make fun of Matisse. So that's one example of what you're calling attention to. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Brancusi, needless to say, it was conservative curators at the Metropolitan Museum of Art who tried to make trouble for bringing the Brancusi in. And in more recent years, there have been any number of episodes. For example, perhaps the most notable controversy that divided the art world was a GSA, General Services Administration commission in 1979 to Richard Serra to place a work of sculpture that he would design on Foley Plaza in Lower Manhattan. And so he created something called Tilted Arc, which is 72 feet long, 12 feet high, 2 inches wide. It's made of steel that was intended to rust. And it's really a very menacing-looking thing, or it was a very menacing-looking thing. 1,300 people who worked in the federal office building overlooking Tilted Arc petitioned to have it removed. And in 1985, so the work went on was put in place in 1981. The petition to have it removed emerged promptly, and the art world critics were quite divided. So the GSA held hearings, public hearings, in 1985, and what's so interesting about those hearings is that more people testified in support of the work than in defense of it. But we know from interviews and private correspondence and so forth that many of the people who testified on behalf of Tilted Arc, that is to say, not having it removed, did not have a very high opinion of it, but they supported it because they feared the precedent of the federal government having the right to simply remove a work of art that it didn't like. The whole notion of censorship scared the dickens out of the art community, but eventually, in 1989, in the middle of the night, the federal government did come and disassemble Tilted Arc, and to this day, it sits in a warehouse in Brooklyn. But that's an instance where, for example, a very distinguished art critic, Arthur Danto, who's been for many years the art critic for The Nation, the journal called The Nation. Arthur Danto wrote publicly his reasons why he felt that the work did indeed seem menacing and inappropriate, because the way in which it curved was totally counterintuitive, and really did not fit the space. And Serra, by the way, was quoted as saying that he fully intended the work to be, in his word, confrontational. And that's very typical of many of the artists of Serra's generation, that they do intend to be confrontational because they tend to be iconoclastic.
Yeah. Well, that I suppose that fits in with with the kind of popular and romantic notion of the artist as being someone who is anti-establishment, who is going to be challenging the accepted way of doing things. I think that the notion of art students burning another artist in effigy, now I think that's pretty shocking. But you know, I also know that it's true throughout history that there probably is always an accepted way of doing things, the approved way, and that then there always are artists who are coming along and doing something different, doing it in a different way, and generally they're not going to be accepted. They're certainly not going to be accepted by the Academy and the popular taste, because they're used to seeing one thing. They don't like it because they say, well, this isn't art, and that that in fact there are no doubt throughout the history of art, probably throughout the history of art, those kind of things have happened.
You're absolutely right, and the decade of the 1960s was especially pivotal in this respect, because during the post-war years of prosperity and a good deal of freedom for young people to choose career paths that they wanted, a very, very sizable number of young people went to art schools, and the number of art schools available proliferated. There, by the later 1950s and early 60s, there were a great many art schools, and they were turning out very, very large numbers of artists with MFA degrees and comparable certificates. And so the expansion of the number of artists seeking to make a living from their work, rather than working in a framing shop or a paint shop by day and doing their artwork on weekends and at night, the numbers simply proliferated. And in order to gain attention, one had to do something not only different, but it helped to be a little bit outrageous in order to attract publicity. So, for example, Roy Lichtenstein, the well-known pop artist, was interviewed not long ago, and he looked back on the 60s when he emerged as an artist. And he remarked that the problem for a hopeful scene-making artist in the early 60s was how best to be disagreeable. What he needed was to find a body of subject matter sufficiently odious to offend even lovers of art. And so in Lichtenstein's case, he opted for the vulgarity of comic book images. But others would, as the 60s progressed, between the divided population over civil rights issue, and then the even more bitterly divided population over the war in Vietnam, resulted in a number of artists becoming very alienated, very anti-establishmentarian, very very eager to have their work reflect their political views. And so there were a number of art exhibitions and particular works created during the later 60s, that were totally intended to be provocative. I'm thinking of Kate Millett's Old Glory, in which she took a toilet bowl and draped an American flag over it and somewhat in it, and called it "Old Glory has gone to pot." That sort of thing led to the arrest of the three artists who organized the exhibition in November of 1970. So you have a very, very alienated group of young artists, both trying to just call attention to themselves by, for example, creating pop art, in the case of Andy Warhol and Jasper Johns and others, but then the politicization of young artists led to a good many outrageous works in the later 60s and early 70s.
Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Just a couple of quick comments, and I'll go ahead and ring off. I did want to agree with your guest. I spent a fair amount of time in Washington in the mid-70s, and when was on Bloom, it was just a spectacular.
Oh, you know, we're kind of losing you there.
Oh, okay. How about, is this better?
A little bit. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll make it real quick.
Sure.
About 25 years ago, there was a painter who did a rather outlandish, outrageous painting of Harold Washington, and to put it up in the Art Institute, and the black alderman in Chicago came and took it down just because it was so distasteful. And I remember the artist saying, "You can't do this. This is art." But I think it dovetails nicely in what your guest was saying. You know, the more outrageous for an artist to be recognized, you know, that's what they were searching for. And I don't remember if your guest recalls that or not, but it seems to dovetail nicely into what he was talking about. And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen. Thanks.
Sure.
I do indeed recall it. I talk about it, that episode in the book. There were several reasons why the artist David Nelson created that work. He was not anti-black, but Harold Washington being the first black mayor of Chicago, but he was against what he called the deification of political leaders, and he felt that Harold Washington, along with many other prominent figures in politics, were treated too deferentially by the public. And so he created this image of Harold Washington wearing women's lingerie. Well, the other reason for that was because Harold Washington was not married, and people speculated on whether or not he might have been gay. So Nelson, in an effort simply to show the humanity rather than the godlike qualities of the politician, decided the best way to do that would be to show him in drag or in women's lingerie. And you're quite right that the a black alderman insisted that it be removed, and there was quite a ruckus over that. And the Art Institute of Chicago and the School of the Art Institute have actually been the venue for a number of controversies during the 60s and 70s. There was another one caused by yet another student, this time an African-American student named Dred Scott. He took Dred as a nickname to refer back to a famous case of involving slavery back in the 1840s and 1850s. And Scott's work involved an American flag that you had to walk on in order to see the images of the American flag that were attached to the wall, and in order to write your comments on a book that was on a shelf attached to the wall. And that horrified a number of people as desecration of the U.S. flag. And that controversy actually angered more people and generated a controversy of longer duration than the Harold Washington controversy.
It sort of puts me in mind, this is in a little bit different, but it has to do with the way leaders are portrayed, and again makes this point about how old these controversies are. It puts me in mind of the controversy about the 1841 statue of Washington, the one that shows him wearing a kind of a toga sort of a thing. He's sitting in a big chair wearing this, and he's bare-chested.
That's right.
And a lot of people were horrified at the idea of Washington being portrayed that way.
You're absolutely right. The statue was created by Horatio Greenough, who was probably the foremost American sculptor of the day. The commission for that work of sculpture was intended to be another part of the solution to the question or problem, how will we honor George Washington 100 years after his death? So Congress gave Greenough that commission in 1833. The work was completed at Greenough's studio in Florence, Italy, where he was surrounded by examples of Roman sculpture. And so the statue of Washington, the head bears a pretty good likeness to the face and head of George Washington, but the body, everything from the neck down, basically looks like a Roman senator. So the hybridity of it was off-putting to a lot of people, but the biggest issue was what they called Washington's nakedness, even though he's covered from the waist down. But being so exposed brought interesting comments. For example, the mayor of New York, Philip Hone, wrote in his diary that Washington was too prudent and careful of his health to expose himself thus in a climate so uncertain as ours, to say nothing of the indecency of such an exposure. People, Washington is totally covered from the waist down by drapery, but one person referred to how horrifying it was that Washington was sitting there with only a napkin covering his genitals. And the best comment of all came from Nathaniel Hawthorne, the novelist, who asked rhetorically, did anyone ever see Washington naked? It is inconceivable. He has no nakedness, but I imagine was born with his clothes on and his hair powdered and made a stately bow on his first appearance in the world. So by 1843, there were a lot of complaints about the statue dishonoring Washington rather than honoring him. When Greeno got to Washington finally and saw how poorly the statue was illuminated in the rotunda, which is the spot it had been designed for, he pleaded with the authorities to move it out to the East Plaza, where presidents are inaugurated. And the authorities complied with that request, but the pigeons also complied, and the statue got whitewashed, and it had to be cleaned, and then the pigeons would do their thing again. And this went on until the end of the 19th century, when it was finally moved to the Smithsonian. And ever since the 1960s, it's been part of it's one of the first things you see when you enter the National Museum of American History on the Mall. But it certainly stirred up a lot of trouble in the 1840s and 1850s.
Yeah. Let's take another caller here, someone on a cell phone again, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from my cell phone and very interested in the program here. Just thinking back to late 60s, early 70s possibly, and not exactly sure which, but in hearing your conversations about major national settings such as Washington, D.C. and New York, thinking about a flag, an art controversy at Millikan University when I was in high school, a design that was called Flag and Chains. I believe that the artist at the time at Millikan University was arrested for that display. It was an anti-Vietnam War statement. And again, just finding it interesting that a number of statements and throughout history coming from, you know, the heartland or smaller communities. And were you aware of this particular event? And is it that well publicized? Thank you. I'll hang up.
All right.
I was not aware of that particular one, but during the late 60s and early 70s, there was quite a rash of flag desecration cases that came to court. There's one that occurred in 1966 where a Marine veteran, actually, who was very opposed to the Vietnam War, his medium was soft sculpture. And he liked to use the American flag in his work. He did, for example, basically a body bag with the American flag as the bag hanging from a noose, and that was displayed in the window of a gallery on Madison Avenue in New York City. There were other uses of the American flag in the gallery as part of the show. One showing a cross. A rather large cross with a bishop's mitre on top, and something that would appear to have been a penis, but wrapped in a small American flag sticking out about one third of the way up from the cross. So the owner of the art gallery was arrested. He was convicted. There were a number of appeals. This began in 1966, and only in 1974 was he finally exonerated by a federal appeals court. That issue had actually gone to the Supreme Court, which split 4-4, which is why it could then go to an appeals court for a final decision. But the point is that Congress ultimately tried to pass laws making it a federal offense to desecrate the U.S. flag. The Supreme Court eventually would rule unanimously that the flag was not some religious sacred object and that people could do with it as they wanted, even though the justices didn't particularly approve.
We just have a couple of minutes left. There are so many more things I would like to be able to talk about. Just really quickly, one point that I think is worth mentioning here at the end when we talk about how sometimes the controversy is generated from within the art world. I think back to all of the hoo-ha about the 1999 sensation show in New York. that caused this was a show of contemporary British artists
right.
that got a lot of attention and was controversial. And that as a result of the controversy, probably a lot more people went to see the show than would have otherwise. And it drove the value of the artwork up tremendously. So the artists ended up, everybody who was somehow associated with it ended up benefiting. I'm sure the museum benefited because more people went. And the artists ended up selling their work for probably more than it would have been worth otherwise. So as far as they was concerned, probably the controversy was just great.
Oh, yes. There have been any number of shows mounted, particularly in the last 15 years, where the directors of museums knew that there would be that the shows would generate a great deal of publicity and a great deal of adverse publicity. The Guggenheim Museum in New York, with motorcycles going all the way up Frank Lloyd Wright's ramp in the Nautilus-like atrium, that controversial exhibit, which Tom Krenz, the director and still the director of the Guggenheim, knew would generate controversy. But the interesting thing is, thousands and thousands of people who had never before set foot in an art museum came to see it, arriving on their motorcycles with black sleeveless shirts and tattoos up and down their arms, and they gladly paid $85 for the catalog for that show, and it remains the all-time best-selling catalog for any art exhibition. And there was another a show devoted entirely to the American flag in art that originated in Cleveland in 1994, and the director of the art museum in Phoenix, Arizona, deliberately asked to have that exhibition sent out there, where many, many people were offended by it. There were great protests against it, but the show drew more people into that art museum, paying for admission, than all the shows put together for the previous 10 years. Mm. So controversy generates interest in art, and as you pointed out, attendance tends to spike when the media find that something is spicy and calls people's attention to a particular museum.
There we must stop. There is much more in this book. If it sounds interesting to you, head out to the bookstore and take a look for the book Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. It's published by Knopf by our guest, Michael Kamen. He's professor of American History and Culture at Cornell University. And Professor Kamen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a Focus 580 program that we first broadcast on November 10th. This and many past shows available on our website, WILL.UIUC.EDU. The broadcast today made possible with support from your Colonial Pantry convenience store, offering a wide variety of snacks, foods, beverages, and hot coffee to go. Colonial Pantry encourages you to join them in supporting WILL. That is it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the life of Colin Powell. We'll rebroadcast an interview with journalist Karen DeYoung, author of Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell. That will follow the 1 o'clock news. In the noon hour, Mike Sola will have the weather forecast, and then you'll have an opportunity to talk to Mike. If you have plans to travel this weekend or early next week, you can give us a call. Talk to Mike. He'll give you a forecast for your destination. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, March wheat is trading at $5.15 and a half, up 7 and a quarter. In Chicago, March wheat trading at $5.14, up 10 and three quarters. May, $5.17, up 9 and a quarter. March corn, $3.83 and three quarters, up 6. May, $3.91 and three quarters, up 6 and a quarter. July, $3.96 and three quarters, up 5 and a half.